I have been talking about the story of vine stock transmission in Australia. In the first two parts, I talked about the early days of colonisation in New South Wales and where the vine stock came from. In this third part, I will bring your attention to the very early 1850s when a colonial wine industry started to really kick off. In 1851, the colony of Victoria was established the same year that gold was discovered. This colony became one of the wealthiest places on earth and attracted prospectors and settlers from other colonies in Australia and all around the world. Incredibly, South Australia almost went bankrupt as it lost the majority of its manpower. Colonial wine consumption increased, resulting in strong demand for new vine stock material. Australia's colonial nurseries were never so busy distributing vine stock material around Australia. And wineries were also busy propagating their own vines to expand plantings. I should also stress at this point that Australia's founding wine pioneers were on the most part quite knowledgeable about vine stock by the 1850s and 1860s. The various city botanic gardens were seen as repositories to acclimatise plant material before it was propagated and made available to farmers, and by extension, nurseries like Camden Nurseries and Bailey Gardens in Adelaide were seen as places where the best selections and acclimatised material could be sourced. The most dominant varieties were Shiraz, Cabernet Sauvignon, Grenache, Mataro, Pinot Meunier, Pinot Noir, Riesling, Muscatel and Semillon. But of course there were all sorts available by this time. To add confusion, wines were often labelled not by variety but by style, like Burgundy, Claret, White Hermitage or Madeira. Charles Ferguson at Hortons in the Swan Valley famously planted Cabernet Sauvignon in the 1860s, which were first brought out into Western Australia during the 1850s, and probably not the Cape Colony, as the Western Australian Department of Agriculture suggests. And there are reasons for this. Firstly, Cape vine stock by the 1850s was regarded as generally inferior. There was a thriving nursery business on the East Coast, and Charles Ferguson, who is the owner of Hortons, claimed his vines were sourced from Leshino in southwest of Western Australia and South Australia. And there's a report in Perth's Inquirer and Commercial News of 1862 that said Cabernet Sauvignon and Malbec were brought out to Western Australia by a Mr. Chauncey. And this Mr. Chauncey is probably connected with the Assistant Surveyor General of the time. The Horton clone of Cabernet Sauvignon, which forms the backbone of Margaret River's success, derives from 1930 plantings at Horton's. It is probably genetic vine stock material related to those original imports of 1860s. And there's a compelling case that the provenance goes back to William MacArthur's importation of 1837, either directly or through his agency nurseries. And this could also be said of the Dorian and Rennell selections, which were both taken off 19th century South Australian planted colonial vine stock material. The most prolific and successful clones, SA125 and SA126, both taken from the 1942 planted Dorian vineyard, could be closely related, remembering that South Australia's quarantine laws saw virtually no new material coming into that colony, state, from around 1875 until the 1960s. When Fowler and Company planted its Cabernet vineyard on the western edge of the Barossa Valley in 1888, this material would also have been sourced within the South Australian colony. Penfold Block 42, which is the backbone of Bin 707, could also be related to the same provenance. Plantings were prolific in the 1860s and 1870s, and this was helped by all sorts of brilliant things, like Britain's preferential duty on Cape wine finished, the fall in shipping costs, and the creation of off-licence wine businesses all over Britain, meaning more distribution to customers. And to put all this into context, Australia's exports quadrupled during the 1860s and doubled again by the mid-1870s. That acceleration was extraordinary, but they still represented a fraction of what was to come in the 1880s and 1890s. Plantings in the Barossa Valley, McLaren Vale, Clare Valley, northeast Victoria, central Victoria, and around Melbourne all started to take off. and this was also aided by new technology, including the pruning device, the secateur. Yep, I know we're all familiar with these devices today, but the secateurs were truly groundbreaking at the time, like wide comb wool shearers, only that vineyard workers didn't complain or strike. In fact, the invention promoted pruning competitions all around Australia, which became massive community events. In 1861, in South Australia, 14 nurseries advertised grapevine material, and these also included Yolumba, Stonyfell, Ranelagh and Avondale. Significant investment in wine production also took place in South Australia, Victoria and Western Australia, and everything was designed using the latest in architecture, steam-powered technology, including crushers and presses. Among the investors were people like John Pinney Bear at Chateau de Bilk in Victoria, in central Victoria, who called for 1 million cuttings of vines, the equivalent of 500 acres of planting material. He didn't quite get that much, but it promoted trade and vine stock movement. There were others too. All Saints in Rutherglen, with its marvellous Chinese dormitory for its vineyard workers, James Fallon's Murray Valley Vineyard in New South Wales, Aldana near Adelaide, as well as Penfolds, which instigated massive new works at McGill, Seppeltsfield in the Barossa Valley, and later Chateau Tanunda, Tintara and Tatachilla in McLaren Vale, Horsens in Western Australia. There are many still intact or restored wineries from this period dotted around Australia, especially around Melbourne and Adelaide and surrounding regions. These buildings reveal a lot about the mindset and ambitions of our early forefathers. An example is the still intact Yeringberg Winery in the Yarra Valley. Although built in brick and timber, it follows the design of a Bordeaux cellar, a bit like a miniature Chateau Ponte Cane, and clearly shows that there was an ambition to make claret, although it also achieved a reputation for its white hermitage. The original vine stock material of Cabernet at Yeringberg was supposedly from a consignment from Chateau Lafite via Geelong Nursery, but this story could also be linked to Camden Nurseries. But that original vineyard was ripped out in 1921, not from phylloxera, but because of an economic slump. Joseph Best's Great Western Cellars was also important. Aside from the amazing architectural winery buildings, especially built to produce champagne sparkling wines, there's an even greater legacy. Best's nursery block at Concangella, planted in 1868, still survives and includes Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, Shiraz, Cabernet Sauvignon, Dolcetto, Mataro, and Riesling, and several unidentified varieties. The vine cuttings were purchased from the nursery Truett and Blompied at Great Western, who began a thriving nursery business in 1863. And again, this material could have come via Camden Vineyard, which was extremely active with nurseries and vignerons in Victoria. The list of varieties also promotes that theory. In 1877, phylloxera was officially discovered at Fiansford in Victoria, although it was first observed in 1875. The arrival of this pest, which eats off the roots of the vines and causes the vines to die, was inevitable considering the rapid transport and technologies like the Wardian case. But it had a devastating effect on the wine industry in Victoria and New South Wales. And by the mid-1880s, Camden Vineyards was no more. Thankfully, Sir William MacArthur had died a few years earlier and never witnessed this sad ending. But the survival of South Australia's vineyards, all on their own roots rather than American rootstocks, is a testament to South Australia's colonial government and the vigorous support of those policies by wine figures like Patrick Ault and particularly the vigneron Thomas Hardy. Although there was actually a big scare in 1879, the quarantine laws have been strict and effective and have protected South Australia's wine industry for nearly 150 years with various laws, including the Phylloxera Act of 1899. Unfortunately, despite the efforts of industry bodies and existing quarantine laws, there is a maverick element in the Australian wine industry where machinery is crossing borders without being properly sanitised. And I just wonder how long South Australia can be impervious to this phylloxera threat. But phylloxera also caused a scorched earth policy in the 1860s, not unlike Melbourne's lockdown of 2020. Vineyards in the Geelong area were pulled up, and this soon extended to other parts of Victoria. The thriving wine industry around Melbourne was destroyed, and aspirations for a great fine wine industry imagined by settlers faded away. When St. Hubert's Winery won the Kaiser Wilhelm Trophy for the best exhibitor in Melbourne's 1880 Great Exhibition, it was a high watermark for Victoria's wine industry, even though that trophy should have gone to a New South Wales producer. Such was the politics of the time. Unsurprisingly, overcropping in many of Australia's agricultural regions became a significant problem during the 1870s and 1880s because it led to a decline in soil quality, fertility and yields. Phosphate for fertiliser wasn't imported to Australia until 1905, so farmers looked towards alternative crops, especially currants, wine grapes and orchard fruits. The landscape of the Barossa Valley, Clare Valley and McLaren Vale, once sweeping vistas of wheat and barley fields, changed markedly during the 1880s and 1890s. It was also during this time that many agricultural colleges were founded in the Australian colonies, especially Roseworthy Agricultural College on the edge of the Barossa Valley in 1883. This was a golden period for the wine industry, which for the first time attracted significant capital for winery and vineyard developments, even during the Depression years of the 1890s. There are an amazing number of wine entrepreneurs, people like Walter Rennell, Thomas Hardy, Sir Samuel Davenport, Thomas Highland of Penfolds, and John Riddick, who created the Coonawarra Fruit Colony. When you read the list of surviving vineyards from this period, there are much more from the 1880s and 1890s, and most of them are Shiraz. The success of Australian Burgundy wines in the British market during the 1880s and 1890s propelled the Australian wine industry. The most successful exporters were the Emu Wine Company with its Emu Burgundy brand and Peter Bon Bourgogne with his Tintara brand. Bourgogne brought from Hardy's, Ranella, Wirra Wirra, Sepult, Fowler's at Kilimna and Springvale in the Clare Valley, amongst several others. He did more than any other individual to promote the cause of Australian wine at the time. Nonetheless, when he started criticising the Australian wine producers for making thin wines, probably a result of overcropping, many industry figures were offended, but it was a shot over the bows. Between 1890 and 1900, Australian wine exports grew from 155,000 litres to 3.8 million litres. Aldana, Emu, Keystone and Tintara Burgundies were the major brands of these times, and these wines were based primarily on Shiraz, Amataro and Grenache. But remember, these wines were all sent to England in hogsheads, and they were shipped down the railway lines that had been newly established throughout the colonies. Although Shiraz was known to be first imported in 1830 by another wool baron, Alexander Riley, there is no question that the fine stock brought out by James Busby in the early 1830s from the Hill of Hermitage in the Rhone Valley is primarily the ancestral material of most of Australia's Shiraz plantings. It just shows the extraordinary contribution of James Busby, but also the remarkable networking of Sir William MacArthur's Camden Nurseries. Reading diaries and letters, almost every 19th century colonialist with any form of wealth was dealing with William MacArthur during the 1840s until at least the late 1860s. MacArthur's network also flourished because of his collaboration with nurserymen in Adelaide and Melbourne. A provenance of Camden Nurseries meant there was nothing better. Camden Nurseries was essentially an early colonial brand name. The grape variety Mataro, better known as Mourvèdre in France, was often an essential element to Australian Burgundy styles. While Shiraz gave the softness and richness of flavour, Mataro contributed some freshness and vigour. Mataro was grown in huge quantities at one stage, but growers began to graft over their vines to Shiraz because of its success and higher prices, despite the contrary advice of Professor Arthur Perkins, the state viticulturalist and professor at Roseworthy Agricultural College. Tata Chiller, for instance, had over 230 acres in Mataro, just against 33 acres of Shiraz in 1895, which shows how important Mataro was at the time. Mataro also came into Australia in the 1830s and was grown around the Australian colonies, but it had all sorts of different names like Lambrusquat or Espart, suggesting that it may have been imported multiple times. Although we're used to words like Shiraz and Mataro, these 19th century descriptions were a result of trade in English and the butchering of the French language. In some reference guides, there are suggestions that Shiraz came from Persia because there is a city in Iran called Shiraz. But aside from the DNA analysis and further historical evidence over the years, you can easily see how Syrah migrated to Shiraz, to Shiraz, to Shiraz over the years. Mataro was much easier to pronounce than Morvedre, and of course there are Spanish connections too. And when I first arrived in South Australia, vignerons talked about Cabernet rather than Cabernet Sauvignon, which is exactly how it was spelled during the 19th century. Although there are many surviving 19th century vineyards, by far the most are Shiraz, followed by Grenache, and these can be found mostly, but not exclusively, in the Barossa and McLaren Vale. There are also other varieties, like 1850 plantings of Semillon in the Barossa, or 1860 plantings of Sweetwater, that's Chasselas, in central Victoria. There are more or less around 200 vineyards covering hundreds of acres that are at least 100 years old that have still survived, which shows the astonishing resilience of grapevines in the Australian environment. Our oldest surviving vineyards go back to the 1840s, and all are pre-phylloxera vine stock, growing on their own roots. The most famous are those established in the 1860s, funnily enough, including Henschke's beautiful Hill of Grace vineyard, Chateau de Bilk in central Victoria, and Tyrrell's Old Hill vineyard in the Hunter Valley in New South Wales, all of which are still yielding fruit and contributing to fine wine. Lesser known 1860s plantings also include the Gervasoni blocks planted by Italian immigrants at Yandoit near Dalesford in 1863. In fact, Dalesford's original name was Wombat, believe it or not. Vine stock includes Shiraz, Pinot Meunier, known as Black Cluster back in the day, and Chasselas, also known as Sweetwater. These plantings were connected to a thriving business supplying gold miners and other locals with booze. Strict quarantine regulations greatly restricted the movement of vine stock material around Australia from 1875, and this had a massive impact on livelihoods. From a positive point of view, it saved many vineyards from destruction and has given the Australian wine industry a very solid foundation story. But it also prevented a new clonal material from coming in for nearly a century. Although old vine material is romantic, mutations and susceptibility to virus and disease can reduce yields and quality. Plant breeding and new source material are really important for survival and sustainability. In the early 1960s, scientists and growers had to use their collective imagination to improve grapevine selections. The story of Pinot Noir in Australia is endlessly fascinating because it's so surprising and combines heritage, plant breeding and selection so brilliantly well. Notwithstanding the early days of the early 1800s and the 1870s, Australia is only known recently for its Pinot Noir wines. Yet this variety was central to the early colonial period, the beginning of Victoria's wine industry and the present day. As you will remember, Pinot Noir came into New South Wales as early as the first fleets. Gregory Blaxland's first vintages of 1822 and 1827 were based on small black cluster, and we know that James Busby brought out Pinot Noir in the early 1830s, where it was planted out at Sydney's Botanic Gardens, Camden Nurseries in Kirkton. For a change, the most successful Pinot Noir clone in Australia, MV6 or Mother Vine 6, is pure James Busby provenance rather than via MacArthur or Camden Vineyards. After James Busby returned to Australia with his vine collection in the early 1830s, he planted out his private collection at his father's property at Kirkton in the Hunter Valley, and then he disappeared to New Zealand. This property was left to James Busby's sister, who married William Kelman, and it was under his efforts that the Kirkton Vineyard prospered, but it was never the grand visionary nursery like Camden Vineyards. But we do know that cuttings were obtained from Kirkton by local vignerons. Amongst those was James King at nearby Irrawang, who planted his vineyard with Pinot Noir cuttings in 1832. His 1846 vintage was famously described in a letter from James King to Earl Grey in London, and wine critics like James Halliday have drooled over what this wine might have been like. Although the Irrawang vineyard was pulled up somewhere in the late 1800s, the genetic material survived, because in 1921 the celebrated Hunter Valley winemaker Maurice O'Shea took cuttings from the Kirkton vineyard before it too was defunct by 1930, and planted them at his Mount Pleasant winery, also in the Hunter Valley. And these plantings still exist and are the oldest surviving Pinot Noir vines in Australia. They also have direct links to Catalogue 49 Pinot Noir in James Busby's private collection. And therefore we know these surviving vines are genetic copies of Monsieur Ouvrard's vineyard plot in the Clos Vergeau that was growing in 1830. And of course there must have been some mutation over the years, but the link is irrefutable. Maurice O'Shea became famous for his Pinot Hermitage wines using Pinot Noir and Shiraz during the late 1920s until the early 1950s. He was the most celebrated and revered winemaker in Australia during the first half of the 20th century, before Max Schubert, the creative Grange, came onto the scene. But even so, there was not much Pinot Noir left in the Hunter by 1956. In fact, there was only 9 acres, and most of it was really badly virus affected. In fact, according to Lindemann's managing director Ray King, Pinot Noir must was used to build up yeast populations. Around 1962, the brilliant research scientist John Possingham started working at the CSIRO's Horticulture and Viticultural Station. CSIRO stands for the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation. This bloke has a larger-than-life reputation and is really one of the very great unsung heroes of the Australian wine industry. I love, for instance, the story of how he persuaded the Royal Australian Air Force to fly a prototype machine grape harvester from California to Australia in the early 1970s in a Hercules C-130 air freighter. Anyway, in collaboration with other scientists, including state viticulturalist Graham Gregory in New South Wales, Possingham embarked on one of the most visionary viticultural trials undertaken at the time, in which selections of Australia's 19th century vine stock material were obtained and improved, thus ensuring the DNA survival of this valuable pre-phylloxera vine stock material. Max Lake of Lake's Folly is said to have sourced his Cabernet from this program, but Merbein's signature result is MV6, Mother Vine 6. The source cuttings were obtained by New South Wales state viticulturalist Graham Gregory from the Mount Pleasant vineyard, owned by the McWilliams family. The selections were heat-treated and propagated, observed and then released. Initially, there were variants available, including MV4 and MV5, and there are still some plantings that you can find in Victoria particularly. But MV6 is by far the most successful Pinot Noir clone used in Australia and underpins the success of this variety in the ultra-fine wine market. It has prospered particularly well in Victoria. The provenance of MV6, Mother Vine 6 Pinot Noir, is just so clear and beautiful. And although there are many other clones brought in more recently, which have also performed well, particularly from Burgundy, there is a genuine romance about this particular colonial vine stock material. Just at a time when the word colonial has become a despised word, it actually stands for something quite brilliant. Mother Vine 6 Pinot Noir is the results of generations of effort and imagination. Whether it underpins or contributes to a wine, it is known for its colour, density and richness of flavour. And this material has survived and moved through the ages because the people involved were not about what could be taken out of this country, but what they could give to build Australia as a better place. You have just listened to part 3 of my 4-part story about grapevines in Australia, from the earliest days of settlement to the present day. This podcast is produced by Andrew Kayard and Christoph Priddle at Annesley Street Studios in Sydney. Go to part 4 to listen to the next instalment.